Today is Friday, August 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Happy to have you with us. Coming up, massive destruction and an equally devastating human toll following this week's horrific explosion in Beirut, Lebanon.
The city and the people are shaking to the core.
The African continent is approaching a grim number in its battle with COVID-19.
There are now almost 1 million reported cases of COVID-19.
Also ahead, former First Lady Michelle Obama reveals a very personal detail on her podcast this week. It's all on today's International Edition. Funerals are being held as Lebanon continues to reel from a devastating explosion that rocked the capital of Beirut earlier this week. The blast killed at least 130 people, wounded thousands, and left tens of thousands homeless in a country already in a fragile state after months of a spiraling economic crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic. The International Committee of the Red Cross in Lebanon is working alongside the Lebanese Red Cross to provide medical supplies and other assistance to citizens coping with the aftershock of what is likely to be a very long and difficult recovery. Joining us from Beirut is Rona Halabi, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Lebanon. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. First, tell us, what is the current situation on the ground there?
People are now in need of, first of all, medical help, but also shelter and as well assistance to locate their loved ones, because unfortunately there are still people who are missing and families still looking for their loved ones. The city and the people are shaken to the core. The latest casualty update we have is at least 137 dead and 5,000 injured. Meanwhile, as I mentioned to you, many people remain missing. And we as ICRC, along with the LRC, the Lebanese Red Cross, are working on supporting the families in their search for their loved ones. We are getting requests, the LRC are getting requests, and some people are even posting on social media asking for support, you know, posting pictures of the family member asking for support.
As you're supporting people and families looking for people that are missing, and as you mentioned, there are people that are injured and don't have shelter, it sounds like a lot of the structures are also gone. I would imagine the hospitals would not necessarily be able to even cope with this. And then, of course, also in the middle of a pandemic.
In fact, in addition to the strain on the health system and the hospitals that was already there because of the COVID-19 pandemic, three hospitals at least were damaged in Beirut due to the explosion. And those that were still working are overwhelmed with injuries since this happened, with the wounded being treated in car parks sometimes. So what we did as the ICRC, we immediately made contact with hospitals in and on the outskirts of the city to have a quick assessment of their needs. So what we did is we carried out distributions of emergency medical supply to 12 hospitals in and around Beirut. And we continue to support according to each hospital's need. But here I would like to point out that the support that we are giving out now is from our stock that is already available in Lebanon. And with the port now unable to function, this will impact also Lebanon's ability to import the things that are needed for the coming days and weeks. Mm. The Beirut port is actually the pathway for more than 85% of all imports coming into Lebanon. So this is something that's going to have a big impact. And we feel at the ICRC that this is something that it will have a long-term effect. Because as you mentioned, you know, we have the COVID-19 pandemic, but also we are suffering from an economic crisis. So you can just imagine how a family who, for example, has been suffering from the economic situation, maybe some of the family members have lost jobs recently, and maybe now they have a damaged house that they're looking to repair. So we had the protests happening since October, followed by the COVID-19 pandemic, and then we have this now on top of everything else. So this is a big burden on Lebanon, and of course, there's a lot of support coming in from countries. But we feel that the need, especially for medical supply and food, is something that's going to keep being a priority in the time being and for the following weeks. Also, in terms of people who are displaced, there is at least 250,000 families whose homes were shattered due to this explosion. And with the already tightened economy, these families will be struggling to repair their homes and provide food for their families. And we are also coming in to support these families, whether through food parcels, possibly cash assistance. And we are also doing assessments of some main water stations that were damaged in the city, trying to also make them functional again. However, as I mentioned, this will have an impact even on humanitarian aid pipeline, because, you know, we have a lot of relief work coming in through the Beirut port, not only to Lebanon, but also to neighboring Syria, where also there's much needed aid for a lot of families there.
I would imagine, besides all the physical injuries, there is also a lot of distress, emotional distress happening with the citizens there.
Definitely. I mean, for us as International Committee of the Red Cross, we really believe that mental health is as important as physical health. And that is why we have been doing mental health support in the country for the last 1 year at least. But now, yes, we see the need for this kind of support also for a lot of Lebanese that are in a state of shock. So we are actually going to be working on this along with our partner, the Lebanese Red Cross.
So I imagine that the International Committee for the Red Cross, along with the Lebanese Red Cross, will have a lot of work to do for a very long time.
We definitely do, but that's why we are here. But I would like to point out that the LRC has an application and a website where people can go and donate to the Lebanese Red Cross. And also the ICRC will be also starting a campaign in terms of also having support from donors.
Rona Halabi, spokesperson for the International Committee of Red Cross in Lebanon. For many Lebanese, Tuesday's blast was the last straw after years of corruption and mismanagement by a political elite that has ruled for decades. The explosion has elevated anger at authorities for allowing huge quantities of a highly explosive material used to make fertilizers and bombs to be stored in a warehouse at the port in unsafe conditions for years. As nations send aid, French President Emmanuel Macron flew to Beirut on Thursday, where he walked through the rubble of glass and debris and consoled distraught residents. Joining us for details is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, why did the French president feel the need to witness the devastation firsthand right away?
France has always had very close ties with Lebanon. They have a shared history from 1920 to 1944. France was the protectorate there. The two countries have a lot of mutual strategic interests. They have strong cultural, economic, political ties. French is the second language there. And on a more day-to-day basis, France is relying on Lebanon as trying to be a stable force in that area. And let's not forget, they're relying on Lebanon to take in the bulk of refugees, particularly from Syria. They're hoping that Lebanon will remain safe, that it will be a base from which they'll be able to have activities to try and bring an end to the activities of the Islamic State. So yes, France has got very close ties to Lebanon, certainly nowhere near as close as you would see, say, in sub-Saharan Africa. So Emmanuel Macron went there. Certainly he was also taking advantage of a US retreat from diplomacy in that region. And he went there to tell the people, we will help you. We are there. We haven't forgotten you.
It was a quick visit. You could see pictures of him with the people, really showing a lot of compassion. What was the message that he brought back with him?
One thing you have to remember, when you're looking at those pictures of Emmanuel Macron in Beirut, the area near where the disaster happened. That's a very heavily Christian area of Beirut. It's a heavily populated Francophone area. He certainly wouldn't get that sort of reaction in other parts of Beirut. But the message he wanted to give to the young people was, yes, there does need to be change in Lebanon. Yes, the country does have to reform, but it's not France that's going to do it. The message he told them was, you have got to do it. And he made it pretty clear that he wants, and I quote, an independent, transparent investigation into the disaster. And he said that the victims of the families are owed that investigation. On the other side, when he had meetings with the three different political groupings in Lebanon, he was pretty tough. He said that he needed to see reform of electricity, banking, and customs sectors. He said that unless the country reforms, then the country will run out of money, will run out of fuel within the months, because no one's going to give money unless there is reform, particularly political and economic reform. So that was the message that he was bringing. He also made it very clear that this is a long-term engagement France has. Let's not forget, back in 2018, France hosted an international donors conference here. $11 billion was pledged to help Lebanon rebuild back then. None of that money has gone to the Lebanon because it's been waiting for the whole economic and political system to be reformed. So those are the two messages. But on top of that, you know, Emmanuel Macron did, of course, as soon as the accident happened, he did open the way for France to send plane loads of equipment, first responders, search and rescue teams into the Lebanese capital. They are on their way. Further supplies will arrive in the next week. So it's a two-pronged approach from Emmanuel Macron. On the one hand, helping with first aid, but on the other, saying the rest of the aid is dependent on there being a real reform of all the institutions.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much for being with us. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Thursday that the economic recovery around the world could come faster if any COVID-19 vaccine is made available to all as a public good.
Vaccine nationalism is not good. It will not help us. When we say it should be a global public good, it's not sharing for the sake of sharing. It's only because it has advantages. For the world to recover faster, it has to recover together. Because it's a globalized world, the economy is intertwined. Part of the world or few countries cannot be a safe haven and recover.
Speaking in an online panel discussion with members of the Aspen Security Forum in the U.S., moderated by NBC, Ghebreyesus also expressed gratitude to the U.S. for its long history of generosity and support and leadership in global health. The United States is the biggest overall donor to the WHO, but President Donald Trump has given notice that the U.S. will withdraw from the agency in a year's time.
Its leadership and support has really saved many, many lives. We appreciate that. We appreciate the generosity and leadership of the U.S. Then now, when the U.S. decided to withdraw, the problem is not about the money. It's not the financing issue. It's actually the relationship with the U.S. which is more important, and its leadership role.
With more than 157,000 coronavirus deaths in the U.S., President Trump said Thursday he's optimistic that a vaccine will be ready this year, possibly in time for the November 3rd presidential election. The African continent is fast approaching 1 million confirmed cases of coronavirus, with South Africa leading with nearly 500,000 cases. World Health Organization experts have confirmed that they will send a team of experts to South Africa in the coming weeks, as the health minister warns the nation could see a second wave. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
5 months after the first case of coronavirus was recorded in Africa, the continent's known caseload remains a small share, just 5% of the global burden. But, says Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, WHO Regional Director for Africa, officials are concerned about the continent's hotspot, South Africa, and the rest of the continent as it approaches a grim milestone.
The realization is dawning strongly that we will have to live with this virus for some time. There are now almost 1 million reported cases of COVID-19 in Africa, so we have not yet reached that milestone, and over 21,000 people have sadly lost their lives. South Africa remains the worst affected country on the continent and is now the fifth most affected country globally. In partnership with the Department of Health in South Africa, WHO is deploying more than 40 regional experts to provide support at the national and provincial levels in the country.
But she said experts worry the true burden could be higher than they know because of a lack of testing kits and other barriers.
I'm often asked whether they reflect the true picture of the epidemic or not. One of the constant and concerning challenges in many African countries is a shortage of kits to test people for COVID-19. At the same time, some countries have increased their testing per capita while maintaining a low positivity rate, countries such as Mauritius, Rwanda, Cabo Verde, and Botswana. Through the UN supply portal, we are supporting countries to replenish test kits and other commodities.
South African Health Minister Dr. Zweliem Kiese said the nation's strict 9-week lockdown has helped slow the spread of the virus, but that unless the country keeps up its guard, he fears a second wave may be imminent.
It is possible that instead of these lines going down, when we start opening up the movement of provinces and opening more sectors of the economy and people move more easily, the sporting and all the others, then this whole surge can come back again at a much higher level than what we're seeing here.
In Rwanda, Health Minister Dr. Daniel Gamije says officials are looking at novel ways of handling treatment with a national preparedness plan that so far has cost $73 million. The tiny landlocked country has reported 2,104 cases so far. Although Rwanda is small, he said, officials quickly realized they needed to study how to manage the virus within the home and at the district level.
We came to realize that at the beginning, our response was driven by the central government, at the central level from the Minister of Health. And it appears that we could not sustain that kind of interventions initiated from the central level. That's why we decided to decentralize COVID-19 response.
Globally, the Americas have the highest number of cases with over 9 million. Of those, 4.6 million are in the United States. More than 18 million cases have been reported worldwide. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The long-running dispute between Egypt and Ethiopia over the Nile River Dam remains unresolved. And on the streets of Cairo, Ethiopian residents say racism and hostility against them are intensifying. This comes as rains in Ethiopia are filling the reservoir of the controversial dam upstream, a development Egyptians see as an existential threat. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Istanbul with Hamada El Rassam in Cairo.
300 million people depend on the Nile River to survive, and in Egypt, 95% of the population lives along the river. Upstream from Egypt is Ethiopia. Ethiopia has built a nearly $5 billion dam project it says will provide electricity to 65 million people and help lift the country out of poverty. Egypt sees the possibility of lower water levels as a threat to its very existence. Ethiopian refugees in Egypt are caught in the middle. Taher Omar Huru is an Ethiopian refugee and a local refugee community leader in Cairo. He says there has been a rise in hate speech, harassment, and violence against Ethiopians or people perceived to be Ethiopian, raising fear among refugees. Egypt hosts more than 100,000 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, and many of them say they are the target of open hostility on the streets because of the dispute over the dam. With increased racism, even simple things are more difficult, say refugee advocates. This is Noor Khalil, a legal consultant for refugees and migrants. He says black refugees are commonly discriminated against because locals assume they are Ethiopian and they want to block the water. Online, Egyptians and Ethiopians taunt each other. Ethiopian TikTok users suggest Egypt will be completely cut off from the Nile. Egyptian users retort with posts about Egypt's considerable military prowess.
دي بتبقى عامل مستفز كبير جدا لينا لانه انت بتتكلم في انه الناس بتقول
This is Michael Thabet, a Cairo resident. He says the online bickering is fueling growing tensions on the ground. Egypt's critics say the country has long used its power to bully its neighbors and control the Nile. Critics of Ethiopia say that without a legally binding agreement regulating the use of the dam, the country could devastate its downstream neighbors and violate international law. Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan are still in talks, trying to negotiate a deal as the reservoir is slowly being filled up. But sub-Saharan refugees in Egypt say the anger on the ground is misdirected against them. They say, if Egyptians go thirsty, we will go thirsty too. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
President Donald Trump billed his trip to Ohio Thursday as a chance to promote economic recovery, but he quickly pivoted to a deeply personal attack on Joe Biden, even questioning without foundation the former vice president's faith. Trump's remarks signaled how contentious the campaign may get over the coming months. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
After Texas last week, the president was in another state his campaign thought was locked up, Ohio. The plan was to pitch an economic recovery, but the president shifted to a deeply personal attack on Joe Biden.
He's against God. He's against guns. He's against energy, our kind of energy.
Even as the president promised workers at a Whirlpool plant the economy will recover from the virus, his handling of the pandemic has weakened his reelection bid and affected his visit, with Ohio Governor Mike DeWine testing positive hours earlier. The trip kicks off a weekend of fundraising, with Biden chipping away at the president's financial advantage. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Former First Lady Michelle Obama says she is suffering from a low-grade depression in the midst of a pandemic, rough race relations in the U.S., and political discord. On Wednesday's episode of the Michelle Obama podcast, she chats with Washington Post opinion columnist and friend Michelle Norris about the rise in protests over racial inequality in the wake of George Floyd's death in police custody, and said the mounting stories of black people being wrongfully arrested and killed have also been weighing on her. China on Thursday threatened to take countermeasures over a trip to Taiwan by U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar. This as the Chinese-claimed island gears up for its highest-level U.S. official visit in 4 decades. The visit, which begins Sunday, adds to tensions between Beijing and Washington over everything from trade and human rights to the coronavirus pandemic. China calls Taiwan the most important issue in its bilateral ties with the United States. And Singapore researchers have developed electronic skin capable of recreating a sense of touch, an innovation they hope will allow people with prosthetic limbs to detect objects as well as feel texture or even temperature and pain. The device, dubbed ACES, or asynchronous coated electronic skin, is made up of 100 small sensors and is about 1 square centimeter in size. You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Two NASA astronauts safely landed back on Earth after a trip to the International Space Station. Their historic journey aboard a commercial craft marked SpaceX's first crewed flight, raised hope for future travel. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
Splashdown.
A busy summer of space travel came to a soft splashing end this week for astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. It was the first splashdown by U.S. astronauts in 45 years.
Back on planet Earth.
As we descended through the atmosphere, the thrusters were firing almost continuously. And I think this the sound that makes. I did record some audio of it, but it doesn't sound like a machine. It sounds like an animal.
The reentry is a fairly dynamic event. And you can see from, you know, just an overall view of the capsule that reentry is a pretty demanding environment, you know, with the different scorches on the vehicle, and the windows were not spared any of that.
The two rode a SpaceX Dragon capsule to the ISS and back, marking the first such journey aboard a privately built and owned craft in the space station's 20-year history. The mission's success means another SpaceX crew launch could happen as early as next month, with possible tourist flights next year. Also this week, from Cape Canaveral in Florida, NASA launched Perseverance, its most elaborate life-seeking Mars rover. Research scientist Dr. Bethany Ellman explains the mission.
We will be able to, as before with rovers, drive up to rocks, investigate them, figure out which ones are the most interesting, but this time we'll be able to then core a piece of that rock out into a sample about the size of a piece of chalk.
Stony Brook University professor Scott McLennan says to best study the samples collected by Perseverance, the rocks must land back on Earth.
They're the gift that keeps on giving, because the samples will remain. Our ability to make measurements will evolve. They will get better and better over time, and we can always go back and revisit those samples that we've brought back to Earth.
The samples may hold clues as to whether life ever existed on the red planet. NASA and the European Space Agency will join forces to bring them back to Earth around 2031. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Opera star Placido Domingo returned to Europe to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award on Thursday after surviving a fierce battle with the coronavirus. His visit to the Austria Music Theater to accept the award was his first public appearance since recovering from the virus at his home in Acapulco, Mexico. The 79-year-old, in an interview with an Italian newspaper, vowed also to continue to fight to clear his name over allegations of sexual harassment that virtually ended his performance career in both the United States and his native Spain. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.